For those who care to join us, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in the first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. So if you could raise your virtual hand or wave the screen, Emily. And Robbie.
Hi, I'm Emily and I'm an alcoholic. I'm on day 9. I'm a restart.
Yay, Emily, hey. Welcome. Robbie?
Day 29.
All right. Welcome, Robbie.
Robbie, alcoholic.
Anybody else? First 30 days?
My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, BJ. Love you, girl.
Love you, too.
And I think I saw Callie. I'm going to allow people to unmute themselves here.
And Trevor, too.
I'm Callie. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Stay tuned.
Callie, welcome. So glad you're here. Trevor?
My name is Caroline. I'm on day 1.
Welcome. Glad you're here, Caroline.
And I'm, hi, I'm Trevor. I'm a recovering addict. I'm on day 2.
All right, Trevor, welcome. Anybody else? If I don't see you, just go ahead and unmute yourself. All right. Well, you guys, you are the reason that that we're here, really. If you would like telephone numbers, you can chat to the host. But if you'd like to give your number to one of the hosts or just ask for numbers, we'll get you in females with females, and there's plenty of men that'll be happy to pass on their numbers to you. Yeah, you absolutely are the reason we're here. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous states that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own voluntary contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask-it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to have Carla R. to tell her story. After she shares, we'll take a short break for the seventh tradition and a few announcements, and then we'll ask, and then we'll reconvene and ask questions of the speaker. So please feel free at any time during the meeting to send questions through the chat to the user questions. And I do not want to take up one more minute of her time. I've been looking forward to hearing Carla all week. So please, I give you Carla.
All right. So you want me to stop at 8? Is that, or just before 8?
Sure.
Okay. My name's Carla, and I'm an alcoholic. And what a nice warm welcome. Thank you, David. It's really nice to be here. And I read the email and saw the format, and I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. I really like Q&A at the end, too. I like to hear what's going on with people. And I want to welcome you all if you're new. Welcome. I hope that that you hear something today that might help you stay one more day. And if you don't, and you really don't identify with us as alcoholics, you really can't hear it. You know, there are 300 fellowships that use our steps, and please don't go away without getting help. There's Cocaine Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and Drug Addicts Anonymous and Heroin Anonymous. And oh my God, you know, so if you don't hear something from here today, there's a lot of help available and we just don't want you to go away. So that said, I used to think it was very important to try to figure out why I was an alcoholic. Was it my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? If you had my family, you'd drink too. First, I guess most important, my sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. So I've had a lot of time to think about this. And I've been around a while. And after a while, I started to notice, you know, that there are people who live out in the world who lived way worse childhoods than I ever did, and they never became alcoholic. And on the other side of that, there are people who lived charm childhoods, people like my husband, who, you know, whose family, they grew up loving each other and singing together, and his father painted the family pickup truck the color of his high school, you know what I mean? It was like that family. And I mean, still, after we leave, after a family gathering with his people, I just still walk away with a little bit of a sugar headache, you know what I mean? Because it's just so sweet. And it wasn't like my family didn't love each other, but when something happened, we turned on each other and they gathered together and held each other up. Oh my God. But the deal is, he still sits right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because alcohol did exactly for and to him what it did for and to me. And that's the deal. No matter where we come from, what we believe, you know, what our education is, what our religion or politics, any of that, alcoholism is no respecter of persons. It just doesn't care. And so I'm just glad that when I stopped asking why and I started asking how, I started to get better when I got here and started utilizing this. And it wasn't like I didn't believe in God. I have always believed that there was some great power that runs in and around and through us since I was a small child. I knew that there was something, but I just could never maintain. I could establish I had awakenings, but I just couldn't maintain that, you know. And besides that, when alcohol came along, I could pray and I could have a drink, and a drink was just a lot quicker. You know, it just solved it. I didn't have to sit around and try to figure out what God's will was or any of that stuff. It got it done. And so alcohol began to intervene in my life in a way that nothing else could. And I let it. It became my spirituality and it became my growing up muscle. And it became the thing that made me feel buffered from you and the thing that made me feel connected to you all at the same time. Why wouldn't I use that? Oh my God. And I know that there are people here who come into Alcoholics Anonymous having built and lost great empires. I know that. That is not my story. I peaked out at about 11 and a half and skidded across the bottom till I was 29. And then I got here. And by that time I was tired. And like Father Tom Weston says, I was interested. I was becoming a whole lot more interested. I just, like I told you, we had trouble in our family and I didn't start smoking cigarettes on the Boulevard of Broken Dreams when I was 7 years old. I was kind of a happy kid. I made the most of, we moved around a lot and I was a new kid on the block in school, and I loved sports and I loved academics and school politics and all of that stuff. I was pretty social. But I was kind of competitive too. That doesn't make me alcoholic. It made me a pain in the butt sometimes, but it didn't make me alcoholic. And you know, all that competition, by the time I was in sixth grade, I was tired and I needed a drink. And the deal was, when I took that drink, it worked. And that doesn't happen for 90% of the population. It just doesn't do it for them. And I've seen it. I still get entertained and amused by non-alcoholic drinking. They start to feel it, they put it down. You know, they say, sometimes they don't even want one. They don't even care that there's no booze at the party. It's weird. but I noticed. And anyway, I started to leave home when I was right around the age of 12. I had just had enough. School wasn't working now. Home wasn't working. And I just started to find my hope out on the open road. I grew up in the 60s, so I was always chasing the peace and love people. I loved the hippies. I loved that generation. They stood up, they marched, they didn't take any crap, and boy, wasn't I looking for that kind of power. I just, you know, oh, I just chased them. And as much as I love the peace and love people, I was always ending up with the black eyes. And you know, in those fights, I wanted to be that, and I'm stuck with this, you know, and that's just how that went all the time. And my relationships, everything. And it was the last thing I wanted, but it's what I ended up in. And consequently, because I was out on the road at a young age, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hot spots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and LA Central. And we did that whole deal for a while. And when I was 14, I ran away to San Francisco one more time, always heading to San Francisco. That's where the hippies were. And a guy took us all the way. We got one long ride, and I was with a friend, and he dropped us off right in the middle of this party town called North Beach. And the guy dropped us off. We looked to my left, and there was Carol Doda and her flashing boobs in neon. She was a famous stripper. And to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps. Oh my. And we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex. And we said yes and did the next indicated thing. And boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about this in the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, that after a time, we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. And it certainly seemed that way for me. And I didn't know it at the time, but I had already begun to trade away every God-given talent or potential or gift that I had for the effect that alcohol produced. And if you had asked me back then, I would have said it was just the next indicated thing, that I was just doing it willingly. And a year later, I was admitted to a mental hospital, and I was supposed to be in that place for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered looking child, alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I did not know how to talk about. In fact, it wasn't until I got to AA almost 15 years later that I heard a tape of who I now know was Cubby Selby talking about feeling like a scream looking for a mouth. And I thought, oh my God, you know. But I certainly didn't know back then. And this was not a treatment center. It was a mental hospital. So a lot of my roommates had real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia. And those things stand above, beyond, and besides alcoholism. They're not the same thing. But untreated, when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, I look a lot like them for a while. So they were giving me daily nutritional supplements, athorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I became intimately familiar with 5-point restraints. And that's what I look like at 15. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you better get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy was the boys. I loved all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy smoldering types, you know, the kind, they just sit back there and simmer. And you just never really knew when they were going to blow. And I love those guys. I found them very exciting. Now today I know that feeling is fear, so I stay away, but I didn't know it back then. And you know, we play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, "Who, when will I see you again?" And press our little faces up against the big bay window of the girls' unit and look out at them looking back at us, you know, living in that sweet spot of anticipation, looking across the way, just waiting, if only I, as soon as I, you know, always in the if only, because as soon as I'd get one, I'd think, what the heck was I thinking? You know, that wasn't it. But I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. And the trouble with that is that I was always about half a bubble up what it was I thought I was looking at anyway. Like I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it would dissolve where I stood because it just wasn't it. Just counterfeit, always looked like it was gonna do it. And not until I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous did I learn that it's constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. That's what makes that illusion of separation finally disappear. But I was reaching and grabbing and striving and it just wasn't working. But I didn't stop trying for a while. And I, like I said, I went from the girls unit to the co-ed unit to the unit they put the patients on they just don't know what to do with anymore. And during that year, I had found my way over the fence and under the gate and whatever it was I had to do to go out and get a drink. And I'd stay out for a week or two, and then I'd come back in the front door of that place because that's where I lived. I lived in the nut house. by the time I got to the last unit, I had casts on both of my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting. That was just a different way of emotional release. And I was no longer bathing or getting dressed because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And somewhere along the line, I had begun to surrender to the thought that maybe I was just one of those little nut house lifers that gets to get out every now and then, but I'm always, always going to end up back inside. Why? Because every time I hit the street, I'm right back doing the very thing that got me locked up in the first place. And I couldn't undo that on my own. And even back then at the age of 14, 15, you know, I was always in that torturous state of alcoholism where I was either drinking or thinking about it. I had that allergy of the body early on. It hit me early. That allergy of the body, that means that the more I drink, the thirstier I get, that I can't guarantee if I'm going to have two or 22 once I start to drink. I can never say I'm going to have two and then guarantee I'm going to have two or four or five or even 10. I can't. And then when I'm not drinking, I've got no sufficient substitute. And the effect of it is so good, has been so good for so long that it's all I can think about. And I just can't rest. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, the big book says, until I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort. And I quote the book a lot because I just want you to know where to find it. I want you to know where I found it, because this is what works for me. Whatever I learned in all of those places before, I left there when I left. Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing that goes with me. It comes with me out the door when the meeting's over. It goes with me wherever I am. I needed this. Something happened inside me. And I hope I never take for granted that the horrible obsession to drink alcohol has finally been lifted for me. I ended up going over the wall at that place and into the arms of my boyfriend waiting on the other side. And I always find it amusing that I had a boyfriend who would wait on the other side of the fence while his girlfriend climbed up the chimney and over the roof and over the wall and got in his car, and we drove off into happy destiny. And we lasted 2 weeks, and then my probation officer knew exactly where to find me, and it hurt my feelings to find out he'd called her. Oh my God. Well, and back in juvenile hall and in one place and out another, rehab and at the state hospital and foster homes and finally a girl's home. And my dad used to say, I think they're just trying to buy you some time, Carla. And I think maybe he's right. You know, I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. My baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism when he was 30. And my mom died of end-stage liver disease about 12 years ago. And my last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin, and when she's not drinking, she's on the Vicodin maintenance diet. So something held on to me, or I tripped over myself long enough to be able to come and find you when at the age of 29. I don't know what it is. I don't think God likes me better. I think sometimes even that God lets the really, really tired ones like my sister and brother go home. I just have to look at it that way. They just get to go home. And they were miserable and sad. So I was in this girl's home at the end, and I ended up running away. All of our friends said, San Francisco's gone to seed. You got to go to Oregon where God might be. I never stopped looking. As much as alcohol made me feel like I was having a spiritual awakening, I never stopped looking. I started meditating and doing all that stuff. But I just, you know, like I said, when it fell short, I just take a drink and move on. And, I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too. I always went somewhere new thinking, we're going to have a fresh start, clean slate. We're going to get it right this time. And my friends rented a house and they let me go with them. And two things happened while I was up there. And I certainly couldn't see it at the time. And one of them was there would be days that we'd go without alcohol. I was a terrible thief. I wasn't working. We had no money. And we'd go without booze for a few days. And when I had no booze and I had no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent and very hard to get along with. And my life quickly became your fault. And when I could drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. Again and still at 17, I couldn't guarantee if I was going to have two or 22. And my friends had to ask me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And I tried to stay with my dad for a couple of months, and we hadn't been back together for a long time, and he had to ask me to leave, and I ended up back out on Hollywood Boulevard. And I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka and just went wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party and some days it was surviving, and there was not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name. And 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still didn't know his last name. But I like to bring him up because years later, he was on my eight-step list. On my very first eight-step list, he was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed amends. He'd been nothing but kind to me, did nothing but try to help me. And I went through his life like that proverbial tornado in 6 short weeks, just spiritually, physically, mentally, materially, in every way. So after I made that first round of amends to my family in my first year, and incidentally, there's not one member of my family either who will stand in the doorway even now and say, no, please don't go to the meeting. They never do that. They're just glad I got you. And then so after that, I'd heard all these great amends stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, well, why not me? So I went looking for that guy. I went everywhere I knew to look. And of course, I didn't find him. And my sponsor finally had to say, you know, look, if you're going to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. And so leave it alone for now. And come back to doing what you were doing. You're doing great. Try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Go ahead and do that too, you know. And to tell you the truth, I did not need a lot of convincing in that direction when I got here. When I got here, I knew you couldn't use the words Carla in good character in the same sentence. I knew that. And I knew that I had no self-respect, but I saw that some of you did. And so little nuggets like that from my sponsor, they just helped. It's not in the big book, but it's still the truth. And it helped. And so, you know, then fast forward to right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town. I was committed. I said I'd be there. So I wanted to go. And I love that today. There's nothing, almost nothing like that. Maybe sponsorship is right up there with it. But showing up when I said I'm going to is it. That's the thing. Because I never could. I never could show up. I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know, I just didn't think it mattered. But don't dare not invite me. Got to invite me, but I'm not going. That's how that went. And so I love showing up. Anyway, I made it to the meeting and I gave that talk. And of course, I felt better. And when the meeting was over, the thank you line came through. I don't know, about halfway through, this man stopped and he said, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. Now, only a very well-organized, loving spirit of the universe could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done, just couldn't get it done. I mean, even if I had somehow wrestled that to the ground and made it happen, he wasn't sober yet, you know, in my first year of sobriety. And so all those years later, he was in a better position to understand what it was I was going to talk to him about. And so a few days later, I took him out to dinner and we had a long, long talk. And when it was all over, he said, oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive. And he's right. You know, I think if we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones. And, you know, just somehow, some way, we've managed to slip through a window of grace one more time to come in here and sit together and recharge and regroup and see what we can go back out there and pack into the stream of life. And that was a long time to come. I left Hollywood with another boyfriend. And, you know, the rehabs are full of partners. If you're looking, you know, that's where I got them. And again, flying on the coattails of the 60s, loving the idea of peace and love and all that stuff, but we just couldn't stop knocking the heck out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully. And so we beat each other up and down the California coast and pitched a tent in the mountains in Southern Oregon. And just suffice it to say that I'm the kind of a drunk who sleeps by the side of the road and calls it camping. You know, I mean, I think I'm on a spiritual quest and I'm a hobo. And we ended up pitching a tent in the mountains in Southern Oregon till the rains came. And then we moved across town over to the top of another mountain where we found this old dilapidated log cabin on top of an old mining claim. And we patched up the log cabin and threw a plastic tarp over the top and called it a skylight. And then the baby came. And, you know, I had had enough therapy by that time to know that you got to break the cycle. You got to be the parent you never had. You know, you got to turn it all around and everything. And I knew that up here intellectually. But remember, you know, moral and philosophical convictions galore just don't get it with me. I want to be that and I'm stuck with this. And in the meantime, I'm getting my clothes and shoes and the necessities of life out of a box behind a store in town. And I think I'm going to be a better parent than the one I had because I was delusional. and she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old. You know, by that time we were drinking moonshine and homemade wine because it was organic and much better for you. And she got in the way, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And up until then, I was kind of institutionalized, and I was not able to get out into the workplace. And so now the rubber's hitting the road, and it's time. It's time. And so my first legitimate work was in the bar business. I mean, to me, it seemed to be cosmically efficient. You know, it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? It just seemed to me to be perfect. So I drugged that kid over three states, and you know, it just didn't get any better. And we ended up down in Southern California in a little town called Covina, renting a room from my aunt. And I got a job in Hollywood about 30 miles away, tending bar. It wasn't a bad job at all. It was a great job, as a matter of fact, but it was me. I was the common denominator. And every afternoon I'd kiss my daughter, who was now almost 4 years old. I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd get thirsty about halfway and pull into my favorite watering hole and order up a couple shots of Cuervo and a couple of Bud Backs and drink them down and get up off the bar stool and go to work and pour drinks till the wee hours of the morning and crawl home and start all over again. And I did that for months until one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had been doing, and I took off for Hollywood and I stopped at my favorite watering hole, same drink, same whole thing. To this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours, because I didn't hate the job I was going to. And I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. I sat on the bar stool this day and I drank those drinks. And this time, the pull of knowing that I needed to go fulfill my responsibility at the bar, a job I really liked going to, was not enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. Just not enough. And then the knowing that my daughter was waiting at home, and she sometimes waited up until I got home well after midnight, you know, sometimes she'd last and sometimes she didn't, was not enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. And so that day I drank those drinks and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia until I fell into another job in another dive bar. And here again, I know that we all understand this when we read this line in the big book that they wrote, and no matter where we come from or who our parents were or how educated we are, we all have this in common. Gradually things got worse, and worse they got. I married my drinking partner about the time we should have split up. I thought maybe if I made my life look like I thought yours was, that it would get better. And you know, we used to settle our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. I had black eyes and broken ribs quite often. And I got my daughter back when she was 8 and a half, and I didn't get sober till she was almost 10. And so the plan was almost working, I thought, you know, but here it is. Here it is again. I get my daughter back, and then I end up with one job 5 days a week. And here's where I really began to suspect that I might be down for the count. You know, I had one job, and that was in the afternoon to look at the clock and know that it was time to get up and go get my daughter from school. And so I'd look at the clock and I'd say, I got an hour, I got to go pick up Amber. And so I'd take off and I'd stop at the bar on the way, and I'd look at my watch and I'd see in 45 minutes I got to pick up Amber, so I'm going to have one drink. And I start to drink one drink. And as I drink it, I think I'm going to have two drinks at the most, and then I'm going to go pick up Amber. And then I look at my watch and I go, squeeze three drinks in. And then somebody lines up the bar with shot glasses, and I can't turn down a free drink. So I'm going to have maybe four, five, and six, and then I'm late. And I finally peel myself off the bar stool and I head out and I get to my daughter's school and I go busting into the office, and I'm mad at the staff because I'm late. And as I go walk into the office, I trip over my own feet. And as I fall on the floor, I catch a glimpse of my daughter's face and the look in her eye as her mother goes rolling across the floor of the administration office at her school. You know, I just told you just a snapshot of where I've been, and on the street and in the mental hospital and all of that stuff. But I still don't think that I've experienced pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization quite the way I did when I saw the look in my daughter's eye, because that was not supposed to happen. And all I could feel for a moment was that sense of powerlessness, and then worse, the sense that it wasn't going to change. I wasn't going to change. There's nothing. It can't be the booze. It's not going to be the booze. And I had stopped doing drugs 2 years before I got sober, you know, and copious amounts. And I could not let go of the booze. So we ended up living in a little apartment across town. My husband, my daughter, and I, this little tiny place. And finally, one Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway one more time. The neighbors are watching us one more time. The kids scared to death one more time. And I can't stop drinking. And so none of us planned that. None of us planned to have that happen that day. We all got up and thought, if everybody will just be cool, we'll all be okay. But we start to drink. The cops left. They took the gun. The husband left for the last time. It's me and the kid and the booze, and I can't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, I'm really tired of this. A hard drinker could say, I'm going to go to detox even and get some help for a week or two. And then they'd come home. They'd go back to work. They'd have a story to tell if somebody asked them, but they would move on with their life. I've seen them do it. They're fine. They're fine. They just don't. That obsession doesn't come back. They don't care. They're done. But me as an alcoholic, what I did was I just pulled the booze closer to the couch so I didn't have to keep getting up to get another drink. Because I drank through my circumstances. I drank through drug addiction and homelessness and all of those circumstances in my life. And I love that old saying, there's a bottom below the bottom, you know. Because when I'm in active alcoholism, I don't care what the bottom is. It just doesn't matter. But conversely, and I want to be sure that I say this, after having a real awakening, a complete psychic change at about 9 months of sobriety, there hasn't been one circumstance in over 32 years where I felt like a drink was going to make it any better. The thought didn't occur. And that's a miracle. I hope we're not the people, we don't have the market cornered on miracles, but I needed this one. I needed this one. That's why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. You know, coincidence with a capital C. And I really needed to start at a very basic level because I had so many disjointed ideas about what God was. I thought I had to define and comprehend this power. And here we go again. You know, here we go again. And she said, no, just why don't you just count those situations that seem to fall together for the good of everybody without you having your hands on them. Coincidence. And the first one I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen her that whole deal go down that day. And she came over a couple days later and brought me a big book and a 12 and 12 and just sat on my couch and told me her story. She was a woman properly armed with the facts about herself. And she talked about her drinking. And in that story, I heard me. And then over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking at all anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And I don't know how you do that. Because all I knew is that when I had no booze and I had no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, no sufficient substitute, I felt like you stripped the coating off my wires. I felt oversensitive, underloved. I didn't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. You know, my self-centered head would close in on me from there. So much so that even though I knew a little bit about booze by that time, I knew I couldn't guarantee if I was going to have 2 or 22. I knew that intuitively. I knew that the window of relief had gotten really small. I knew that I no longer had to invite trouble. It seemed to come to visit unsolicited. I have a friend, Kent, who says that if he took a drink now, he knows that a cop would just fall right out of the sky. You know, and I just started to kind of felt like that, you know. So I didn't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences were going to have any effect on me in the face of what I'd become. They just seemed so weak, you know, and I had been to an AA meeting or two and it just seemed so social. And I didn't know how that was going to have any weight, you know, how was that going to do? But again, Father Tom, you know, you got to be pretty sick and tired to find us interesting. And I was becoming increasingly interested. And it was about a week and a half later, I just didn't go back and buy any more booze. My daughter was at her father's house and it was the weekend and I just didn't move. I didn't move out of that apartment. And I shook it out over the weekend. There was no treatment for me anymore. People had been trying to help me all my life. And I was fortunate nothing happened, and I shook into Monday and into Tuesday, and by Tuesday afternoon, I was stark raving sober, And I went back to my neighbor instead of the store. Just one more moment of grace where I slid right over there. I didn't feel like it. I didn't think too much about it. I just went over there and asked her what to do. And she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and that became my first home group. And I went in there and I sat way back by the open door and the exit sign, just in case. And I heard a lot of talk, people trying to help each other. You know that chatter before the meeting, how about sponsors and big books and steps and rides home and coffee and all of that stuff. And then I heard somebody say, "Hey, Joe, how's your lawn?" And I thought, "What? What?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Hey, Joe, how's your lawn?" And I was moved a little bit, you know. I was moved, like, oh my God, could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn, you know? Up till then, it seemed so much about foraging and scraping and holding on. You know, could it ever be just so simple where I'm sitting on the porch and the smell of fresh cut grass is just enough? I don't have to be anywhere. I don't have to do anything. You know what? Nobody's chasing me. That sounded really good to me. It moved me. And the secretary asked me to read something at the end of that meeting, a portion of chapter 11 that we read at the end of a lot of meetings. I took it from her. I said yes. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit more, just like I do every time I say yes to something you ask me to do. And especially when I was new, because the obsession did not leave me easily. And those little commitments, those little jobs we got in the meetings, and even on Zoom, you know, you can be a host and you can hold up signs and you can give virtual chips and we get creative, you know, but to be something that brings us into the room, shaking hands, saying hello to each and every person in the room. It all seems so hokey. And one of my favorite lines in the big book is, "What seemed at first a flimsy reed proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God." And my foundation is just layered with flimsy reed after flimsy reed after flimsy reed. How's that going to work? Who cares? Do it and see. You know, and most everything that I've ever done, suggested that I do has not occurred to me that sounded like a great idea. You know, I didn't go, that sounds right. You know, I just did it and it's worked. So anyway, I got a sponsor and I took the steps with her. I had to drink one more time. I have to say that, just full disclosure, at 89 days, and I had to drink for 24 hours and then I got to come back in, and I haven't had a drink since. And I went up, my sponsor picked me up. She helped me throw out the bottles and took me up to the big book study. And I'm so glad nobody said, "Ew, I smell alcohol" in an AA meeting. Of course I wasn't disruptive, but they accepted me. And somebody came up at the break and asked me if I wanted to come up and make coffee on Tuesday. And I thought, dang, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. And so, and I came on the days in between. And I really had to hang close. I just had to immerse myself in this. Because I just didn't know if it was going to work. And I wanted it to. I needed it to work. So I took the steps with my sponsor and I made that first round of amends, like I said, to my family. And for my family, there was a long period of reconstruction ahead, you know. So if they're not handing you the keys to the kingdom in your first, you know, few months or even a year, like, don't, just be consistent. I had to be consistent, and I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out. It wasn't for me to know how it was going to go. It was just for me to do it and offer it up and be consistent. To this day, not one member of my family needs to know, needs to worry about where I am. They all know, they have access to me if they want it, and that's it. Then other women started asking me to sponsor them, and I have to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours, because in your eyes I see forgivability and lovability and hope and growth where I don't always see it in myself. You know, you draw from me things I didn't know I needed to share, and you share with me things I didn't know I needed to hear. And in, not even in just formal inventories either, but in those little Me Too moments, driving to the meeting or over coffee or over the phone, you know, those little things that knit us together, those moments and help each other along. And after a couple of years, I'd had you guys and my daughter didn't have anybody really. And I love what it says. I love that it says it on page 19. It didn't wait till the end to say that a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our homes, occupations, and affairs. If I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. And I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day for a while, and I probably needed every single one until it was time to change. You know, first my daughter had lost me to alcohol, and now she's losing me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was time for me to go to work, go to one meeting, and go home and be a mom to that kid. And it took time from the time she was about 11 till she was 23 for us to get it, you know, to get to right the ship. And you guys taught me mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. She was 11 years old. She'd been jumped into a gang. She was starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. She was in big trouble and I needed to get her big help. And so I put her in a treatment center. We didn't know if she was alcoholic, addict, gangster, what, you know, but she was in on the fast track. And so I showed up when they asked me to, and I stayed away when they asked me to. And when she was released, she came home for a while, and then she wanted to live with her dad, and I needed to shut up about that too. And when she was 16, she came back to live with me. And when she was 16, she and her boyfriend came and sat down in front of me with a funny look on their faces. And I got to tell them they're pregnant, and they nodded. And I got to tell her that I'll be there no matter what, you know, whatever you decide, I'm here. And so I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. I got to walk with them through all that. And that kid just turned 25 and finished his second year of law school. And I just got to be a witness, you know, and the youngest grandson just turned 19, and he just moved out on his own and on his path. And my daughter just turned 42, and she, a few years ago, she got her master's degree, put herself through school. She doesn't seem to be alcoholic or addict or anything. She just kind of grew up she became a social worker. She's one of those people who goes in the aftermath of things like the Las Vegas shooting and the San Bernardino Terrorist Act, and she's out setting up testing sites and things. You know, she helps people begin to put their lives back together after something like that. And I don't know if she is who she is because or in spite of me, but I know that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be a privileged witness in her life too. And in the lives of anyone who wants to be in mine. It works, and I just love, and I never even know how it's going to go. I try to stay open to anybody coming into my life. I don't do that thing of, oh, well, probably they'll, you know, I'll probably never become friends with them. And as soon as I say that, they walk across the room and ask me to sponsor them or something, you know, or just, you know, you just never know. And that's the fun. It really is. It has become fun. It wasn't fun in the beginning, but now it is. It's interesting. But, so I don't know how things are going to go, but my daughter is beautiful. And at 5 years sober, I was raped by an intruder in my apartment. This was just a couple years after that, after all that with my daughter and when she came out of treatment. But thank God she was living with her father at that point in time. The guy came in through my kitchen window and he had a knife and he put it to my neck and he tied me up with the telephone cord and he said, don't say a word or I'll cut your head off. And he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. He was there for a few hours. And I tried to run at one point and I got to the front door, but the bolt lock I couldn't get it open. And so we had a little wrestling match. And instead of getting more angry, he dropped the knife and he went out the same window he came in. And it turned out that I knew this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, to make use of what they offer, Alcoholics Anonymous is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. My alcoholism being that allergy of the body that happens when I'm drinking and the obsession of the mind to drink alcohol that happens when I'm not. And you treat the spirit. I treat the spirit with spiritual principles and I got better. And out there in church, you know, the danger of doing only church for me and if for me is that they they speak of spirituality and spiritual principles in a general way so that anybody can pick them up and use them. And they're not new or different. And in fact, I get a little bit kind of miffed when I hear people in AA say, ooh, too bad they don't have what we have, because hey, we rent from them. You know what I mean? Like, we got it from them. But they can go home after a Sunday picnic and have a glass of wine. I can't. I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we do here in AA is we take spiritual principles, spirituality, and we aim it right at alcoholism. That's our purpose here. That's what we do here. And then I can go anywhere I want to, and I do. I'm an explorer, still an explorer. I love taking deep dives into all directions, and I like finding the connection, the love and service at the bottom of most of these practices that I see and try. And there was a trial a few months later, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be. So I had to get a character witness for myself. And by that time, I was working at a big fancy investment firm downtown LA. It's a place I never would have walked in the front doors of years before. Very accomplished people walked the halls of that place. And now I was walking undetected because I showed up and did what they asked me to do, like you taught me. And so the division head there volunteered to come and testify on my behalf. And they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, well, she shows up early and she stays late. She was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he had experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify. And I was sitting in the witness stand. And I, you know, up until then, my sponsor had been reminding me that, you know, I need to forgive this guy. And I know she's right. I know that we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. I know that. At 5 years, I get it. It's diminishing to the spirit. Anger might be motivating, but when it becomes resentment, it's a killer. It's a killer for us. And so I know, but the guy had scared me. And at 5 years of sobriety, anger was still my favorite way to deal with fear like that. Man, it just made me feel like I had power. Some kind of power, some kind of momentum, like you couldn't hurt me. But anger at 5 years of sobriety was like a suit that didn't fit anymore. It couldn't be angry. It could not be angry. And so the 7-step prayer became my mantra. All the time I carried it with me. It was my mantra. And so now I'm sitting in the witness stand and I'm willing, but I just can't get, I hadn't been able to get there yet. And I saw him sitting at the defense table, and I realized that's a place where I've sat before and I could sit again. If I were to go out and drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And what happened to me was, what occurred to me was that prayer at the top of page 67 that we use in our 4th step and our 10th steps. And though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were spiritually sick. He, just like me. Haven't I been so out of control in my life at some point where I've caused that kind of damage? Maybe not rape, but something equally as destructive. Haven't I? Couldn't I again one day be so out of control that I could cause that kind of damage in somebody's life? Or am I now so delusional and so out of my mind? Could be, could happen, that I'm hurting somewhere in my life. And so what happened for us, it was, we became 2 alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. I had to know, I have to remember, it's still to this day, that forgiveness is never going to come to me, through me, from a spiritual hilltop. It's just not going to happen. I have to see you as me. We have to be standing on equal ground. And so that part in the book, those pages 66 and 67 are just so important. It's a turning point. It's the turning point where I am ready. I'm ready to release and then to start to write that 8-step list. And even if something has happened to me, I mean, that the trouble that when I used to get confused when I'd read that part in the big book about, you know, our troubles of our own making. Now, there was nothing about that incident that I caused it to happen, but what I do with it is up to me. And so I have a choice to pick up tools and use them and to talk about them and to explore avenues on the way out and to choose to forgive and to choose to do the work to forgive. So that's on me. That's of my own making. And so so the forgiveness came that day. The healing took a while longer, about 1.5 years before the nightmares and all of that stuff disappeared. But and then they revisit once in a while, but not for long. And And when they do, they just arise. And I know it's supposed to come. I call it a spiritual barf. You know, it's just supposed to come up, and it's better when it does. and not just that, but when people talk, you know, people have called me, you get a sponsorship network, you get a friendship network. People know our experiences, and we go, hey, call that lady, call that guy over there. And I got a call. I was sitting in an airport one day, and I got a call from a woman in another state across the country. And I started working with her. The same thing, only maybe even worse, happened to her when she was at work in the middle of the night. And I started working with her, and we worked for 2 years before we ever met each other face to face. And then finally one day at a conference, I got to meet her. You just never know how these are experiences are going to be used if I surrender them and let them. And in fact, when there's something that's kind of uncomfortable or even really uncomfortable coming up, and I really don't want to go through it, the knowledge that somehow, someday, maybe this will be used is a good motivator just to jump on in. It doesn't mean I like it anymore while I'm going through it, but it does help. Anyway, he was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17, and then he did 12, and then he did 3, and then he was in and out, and I don't know if he ever got sober, but my sponsor suggested that I remain willing for him if he ever wanted to approach me and make amends, and I said, sure, I'm not going to look for it, but I would be willing. I know that beautiful things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. I trust it. I wouldn't have to do it alone, but I've talked to some guys in prison where this story helped them too, and so I know it works when we avail ourselves of it. The detective who worked the case came to me after it was over, and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it because it seems to be working. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And, my dad, my sponsor, my sponsees, people from my home group, never once did anybody in my home group say, well, what were you wearing or what were you doing or what happened there? You know, they all had my back. And then we just grow. We just keep going. You know, my first 10 years of sobriety was pretty active with drama. And then the second 10 years got better. The third 10 years, even better. I'm in my fourth decade. And it's, it's the best. It's just the best. And I met my best friend and partner and husband when we were about 10 years sober. And then I was 21 and he had just turned 22. He likes you to know that he's 3 months longer sober than me. We were talking at a conference, the first time we'd ever spoken at a conference together. And there we were. And so we knew each other, started chatting, and it's a conversation that just hasn't stopped yet. And we've been together now 11 years and married 9. And he's my best friend. I can't think of anybody I'd rather be quarantined with. And life goes on, and I wake up in the morning and my feet hit the floor and I say, thank you. And then I go sit in meditation. It's worth it to me to sit for 20 to 30 minutes. I do it solo, and then I do it with the group about 4 or 5 times a week, and more now with things the way they are. And I read, I take deep dives into all different directions. And if God is everywhere and everything, then that's what God is, everywhere and everything. And my sponsor reminds me to ask God to grant me the heart of a grateful servant. Sitting in meditation is not the, it's not always, it's, it just readies me to go out and do my day. It's the way I'm doing it now. I've always done it in my sobriety, but there have been many different ways and many different methods I've used because it just, you got to open the channels differently sometimes. It works. It really does. And, Alcoholics Anonymous does not guarantee that troubles are not going to come my way. It just guarantees that if I avail myself of these spiritual principles, that I'm going to be ready to meet whatever comes my way. And I'm not the crazy person who walked in here before, all those years ago. We get better. We're not terminally immature. We're not terminally, childish. We grow up. We really do. and we become valuable citizens, not just in Alcoholics Anonymous, but out there too. And anyway, that's enough out of me. I can't wait to hear some questions and some sharing. Thanks for letting me share.
Oh, thank you, Carla. Thank you so much. I'm going to allow people to unmute as they see fit for a moment to thank Carla.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Carla.
You are amazing.
No question about it. You are the best.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you.
Outstanding, Carla.
Loved it.
So do you read the questions or do...
Okay, I'm going to just take the meeting back for a moment here. We'll give Carla a little break. And I've posted the PayPal link for Simple Actions in the chat. The Seventh Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And before I read the card, just prompt everybody, please send your questions to the host called Questions. Larry is kind enough to collect them, and we're accumulating questions, and we'll start asking them in a few minutes. So, while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I'll take a couple of announcements. If you want to raise your blue hand, feel free. While that's happening, I'm going to say that the Simple Actions group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hand or wave at the camera. Yay. Love you guys. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Lisa, do you have an announcement?
Yes, sir. I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. We are still needing donations for the pink can. What the pink can is where you are able to take, we are able to take AA books and literature into the correctional facilities for the inmates who are still working the program behind the walls. If you would like to donate, please send a check or money order to the intergroup office, and please make sure you put pink can in the memo. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. All right. So once again, please send your questions to the user questions. And I see a few of them trickling in here. And Carla, thank you again so much. It was just magnificent. We got a history question here. Is AA's anniversary June 10th, Dr. Bob's sobriety date, not Bill W's? Why is that?
Because depending on who you ask, because some people consider the day that Ebby brought the message to Bill to be, you know, they say, well, how come that wasn't the date? But that's, you know, Ebby did not stay sober, and they consider the birth date of Alcoholics Anonymous when it took from Bill Wilson to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob stayed sober. And it was it didn't take the first time with Dr. Bob. He he ended up going to a convention after he had a couple weeks sober. I'm not exactly sure how long, wasn't very long. And he went to a convention, a medical convention, and got just knee walking drunk, and ended up coming back, and he was real sick. He was in a real bad way. His nurse is who he called to pick him up at the train station. And then they got him home, and they remembered he had surgery that day. So they gave him a couple of beers, two or three beers, and a couple of goofballs to settle his nerves so he could go perform surgery on some poor guy's prostate. And he made it through. And then Lois and Bill were sitting around Dr. Bob's and Ann's, Ann Smith and Bill were sitting around the house waiting for Dr. Bob to get home. And Dr. Bob didn't come home till late that night. And what he had been doing was, after he performed that surgery and he was done with his day at the hospital, he went all over town making amends. And that was the beginning of his sobriety, the date of his last drink and the beginning of his sobriety. So that's why we use June 10th. And actually, to be even more obnoxious, there are people now who have looked into the date of that medical convention, and they say absolutely not could it be June 10th. It had to be earlier or later, I can't remember. But we use June 10th anyway. It's the day we celebrate as the birth date of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's why, because it was the culmination and then the going forward of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it didn't even start being called Alcoholics Anonymous. See, you asked. It didn't start to be called Alcoholics Anonymous until a little while later. It was actually the third group of drunks getting together. For a while, it was the Oxford group. Dr. Bob had come off the Oxford group, so they were using tenets of the Oxford group to stay sober, and they were even part of it for a while. Then Bill went back to New York, and the second group was formed, even though they didn't really understand that's what they were doing. The third group in Cleveland is the one that started being called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was started by a man named Clarence Snyder, and his story is the Brewmeister in the back of the book, and he actually considers himself a founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's when the first meeting that they actually called Alcoholics Anonymous. So even though in function, the first two groups in Akron and New York were actually doing the same thing, Clarence considers him. So there's a bit of controversy for you, and you can look that all up. There's actually a good book called The Writing of the Big Book that was written by, it's not published by AA World Services, but it was written as a labor of love by a man named Bill Shaver, and it's about 800 pages. So get a friend and read it, because it's going to, you know, you're going to keep you busy for a long time. But about a lot of the events that fill in the gaps that, you know, Bill had to tell the story pretty quickly through the Big Book and some, and the other AA Comes of Age and all of those. But this other book kind of fills in some gaps there too. So there we go.
Yeah, there's a movement of people kind of advocating that Clarence Snyder get the credit he deserves. Like, everybody talks about Bill and Bob, but
yes, if you go to the Akron Inner Group and take the tour, which I highly recommend, it's just, you know, there's all kinds of stuff there, and there's a walking tour you can take, and Gail LaCroix she narrates, you know, what you're seeing on the walls and everything. There's a newspaper article who says, you know, Clarence Snyder, founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, blah, 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 is what the article is about. So, yeah, it's real. It's real.
All right. Thank you. We have a question from a participant. Can you detail some of your 11th step practices?
Okay. All right. Detail some of my 11th step practices. Well, first of all, since day one, or maybe day two, pages 84 through 88 in the Big Book is where my recipe is for that. And I don't even, you know, I know we say that do the steps in order, but I have never seen a reason why we shouldn't do what's on pages 84 through 88. And I say do it because there are instructions. It's a recipe for things we should do. And I always say that I do a better 10th step when I'm doing step 11, and I do a better 11th step when I'm doing 10. It's all well and good to walk around in the airy, lovey, lovey, lovey land of God, you know, but the 10th step has me continuing, not in a self-centered way, but in a self-aware way of, keeping, you know, tracking that selfishness and self-centeredness, and even preemptively, we get to know ourselves pretty good. And I can tell when I'm starting to make a mess a lot of the time, not all the time, but when, you know, and we can do a preemptive 10th step. And one of my favorite ways, the real short version of a preemptive 10th step, and I bring up 10 because 10 and 11 just go together. They just do. When I was brand new, a lady named Susan used to say to anybody who was having trouble during the day, just say, breathe through your nose. And so I would use that, you know, take a deep breath through your nose. And what I found as a bonus was that it keeps your mouth shut. So I call that a preemptive 10 step. Now, I think what you're asking me though, too, so on 84 and 85 runs through, just incidentally, I see at least all 9 steps in that. And if we wanted to squeeze it in, the 12th step too, but, you know, right in the middle of page 84, this thought brings us to step 10, and it goes all the way kind of backwards, because it reiterates what the stakes are on the next page, saying, you know, it's easy to let up on our spiritual program of action, rest on our laurels. You know, we're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. So it reminds me of the reason that I continue to do what I did in the first 9 steps. You know, it just finishes talking about what 9 and the awakening and all of that. And then it says basically, oh, and just go do that again. And it becomes a working part of the mind. Bill was quoted as saying, you know, don't make a, now, I hope I say this well. He says, don't make such a big deal out of the steps that they become this stilted thing. You know, be kind, watch our, what we're going to say and what we're doing and what we're thinking. We, after a while, we're able to tell, but the recipe is this 84 through 88. And then we start on step 11 at the bottom of page 85. If I never did anything but what it says on these pages, I'd be in great shape. But that said, what I have done over my sobriety has changed a lot in addition to this, not instead of. And some of that is reading another book, some spiritual book. At first it started with people like Emmett Fox, you know, the readers that around the year with Emmett Fox and Marianne Williamson. I have a lot of favorites, Pema Chodron. And then I also found that I'm somebody who I'm very physical. I like to do physical things and I didn't really realize how important that was till I was gifted a 6-month membership in a gym when I stopped smoking. I was almost 2 years sober, and I went into the gym and I found that was very meditative. And not to mention that I found out that what that does is it kicks up serotonin. It brings up our natural antidepressants. And I would leave the gym and I would drive home in tears, in this beautiful, beautiful cry that was, it wasn't emotional, it was physical. It was just a physical reaction, a physical release to all this. Anyway, that was for me. I love what Howard Pollins used to say, God rest his soul. He used to say, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. So for me, the things that charmed my soul were this, reading different teachers that I enjoy. And then also it started with the gym. Then I started rollerblading. And then as I would rollerblade, I started working in Century City. So I'd end up down at the beach rollerblading in the afternoons. And then I started noticing the dolphins and everybody. And then I had a friend who taught me to surf. And I remember Harmony used to kick butt out on the waves out there. And I was trying to learn to surf. I fell more than I surfed, but it was a beautiful metaphor for life as far as I was concerned, because the medium is always moving and you have to continue to adjust if you're going to stand up. And so that I found it was where I felt God and where I felt that conscious contact. Not that God isn't everywhere, but there are certain channels that I've just found. And then I learned to dance after that. I always like to say that I know that there's a power greater than myself, because it answers questions I don't always ask out loud, nor do I always know that they need asking. But it comes, some things come into my life and they're just gifted, and I don't always even realize that at the beginning. But these kinds of things open me up. But the basic recipe in Alcoholics Anonymous for steps 10 and 11 is on pages 84 through 88. And I never leave out 84 and 85. There's a lot of good stuff in there. And then, you know, I've got a Kindle. So whenever I'm reading a teacher or a book that I like on a particular spiritual practice, and they mention somebody else's name, I will download a sample of that person too, and that source. And just, it goes on and on. There's never, it's a journey. It's, you know, I'm not going to, I promise I won't say it's a journey, not a destination.
Now, of course, you mentioned an author and a book, so we've got a couple of chats in here. What was the name of that book again?
Okay, there's one that was in the very beginning called Around the Year with Emmett Fox. It's a daily reader. And Pema Chodron, P-E-M-A-C-H-O-D-R-O-N, wrote a book called Start Where You Are. Which is, you know, basically step two is I'm so, step two means maybe for me. You know, the chapter to the agnostics, chapter four in the big book, all about step two, saying, you know, basically we start where we are and all we have to do is be willing to believe. And it, for me, step two is just a big old maybe. Maybe, and even if you're an atheist, if you are willing to say the process of the steps might take me beyond, might restore me to sanity. Big old maybe, just like that. But the book was Start Where You Are by Pema Chodron, and it had a few other beautiful meditations in there. And now, all these years later, my meditation is really just sitting. Sometimes I'll use a one-word mantra just because it mantra means mind protect, and it keeps me focused. But most of the time, it's just breathing 20 to 30 minutes quiet. I'm not a guided meditation person so much. It's not my deal, but to be quiet. And like I said, some days on sitting, the actual sitting is pretty fabulous, but other days, not so much. Sometimes the head is noisy and everything, but it readies me to go out in the world. And I'm more able to pause and ask. And like I said, do a better step 10 when I'm doing 11 and vice versa.
Thank you. When you were getting started in AA, first year, or however you want to define that, what actions were really difficult for you to take? What of these habits were hard to practice?
You know, talking to people in the beginning, and in real life, I don't know, it felt like forever, but maybe it was just a 2 or 3 weeks even, but where I could walk through the room and say hello to people. I really kind of hid in my coffee commitment. You know, I could be very busy and kind of, you know, elbow you out and not really. And I know that most everything I ever did, because I was willing, I would say that maybe my saving grace was that I was all in 150%, but some days my 150 looked like 60 to you. So it's like, it was the, you know, but it always felt like I was holding my nose and jumping in like that. Okay, now I'm going to go talk to that person, you know, and then go after him. And it was, you know, it might've seemed really awkward, but it was little by little talking to people. And then, you know, redeveloping that relationship with my dad has taken a long time. There have been some big, 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 wonderful times, but also, you know, some real awkward things to get through. But it was worth it. I always say long period of reconstruction ahead, because inch by inch, little by little is how that's gone with them.
Oh, thank you. I suppose we have a general question about sponsorship, but the question that was asked was, how many sponsors have you had? And do you find that a lot of the women who ask you to sponsor them are also victims of rape or abuse?
I am on my 8th sponsor in 32 years. My first sponsor left. My second one was a man, and because the women were not lining up to sponsor me anyway. A lot of them said they didn't have time and whatever, but he had been a friend. He knew the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a good old boy named Lee. He passed away with 37 years of sobriety. I just like to give him a little shout out. You know, he'd say things like, well, that's going to feel a whole lot better as soon as it quits hurting, you know, stuff like that. Like when you're up to your neck in poop, keep your mouth shut, you know, all that kind of stuff. He looked like a big old Jerry Garcia. But then after the rape, it was apparent to both of us that I needed to ask a woman. I wouldn't have thought that, but it was true. And so I asked Marguerite, and she was my sponsor till I was 11. And then I was bankrupt. I got into a bad business deal with a guy and ended up bankrupt. And I heard a lady share, her name was Rita. And not only was she facing bankruptcy, or had she faced bankruptcy and paying all that money back with somebody, but her husband at the time had been molesting her daughter. And so I thought, oh geez, anybody who can walk through that can give me some instructions. So I changed home groups and sponsored. I've had four, and now, you know, every single sponsor brought me to the next. And so I wasn't really sponsor hopping, but, you know, but she moved away. And so I got somebody there in the group, and then, you know, it went like that. And, and the same with my home group. After every 10 years, I've gone to a new home group. Each one taught me something, and I can't leave a home group until I have no resentment, and then I can move on. And so I'm on my fourth home group as well.
Oh, we might come back to that one. There's a really, I think, important question. You mentioned that when you came in, you felt like your wires were stripped now that you weren't drinking at 4 years sober. I still feel that way often. What is your experience with taking that anxious feeling away?
Yeah. Anxiety. Meditation has helped me a great deal with anxiety as well. It's not the reason I meditate, but it sure does help. Meditation has helped what it has done is opened up. Anxiety comes from sometimes thoughts, sometimes it's physical. Sometimes there's just some adrenaline going. I'm not a doctor, so I'm just going to talk about my experience. How meditation has helped that is that it has opened up the what ifs. It's opened up the channels of the what ifs, you know, and that kind of relieves anxiety. If I, instead of going what if, and I don't want, just welcoming in meditation, anything that might be coming, anything I think I may be afraid of. And, you know, our big book is just never stops talking about how fear drives us. And so in meditation, I find myself saying, and this too, if a fearful thought comes up, and this too. And then in my daily walking life as well, oh, and that might be too, instead of either or, you know, if God is everything, then everything is as it should be, even if I don't like it. And so if I can allow that in, I'm facing reality, and I can ask for help, and I use tools, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you that at 4 years of sobriety, I had it down for anxiety. That's why I loved working out. I loved exercising. It helped me a great deal with that loose energy. Also, getting to know people, looking somebody in the eye and shaking their hand and having that smile and giving a smile. Oh my God, really feeling useful, even in just that hour and a half that the meeting lasted, you know, just shaking hands before the meeting, getting there early. I used to get there half an hour early in my first home group, half an hour early, shake hands at the break, get to know people, pick up that 2,000 pound phone, call them. all of that serves to break up that anxiety, but it's an experiment. And I always say too, that I'm my own best experiment. I have to try and really note if, you know, making a list of fears, there's a fear inventory on page 68 that goes with the fourth step, but it can also be done alone. And it talks about fear and courage. And I'm not somebody either. Nowhere do I know that the literature says you can't have fear and faith at the same time. Fear and faith at the same time create courage if we allow it to. That's where courage comes from. So we keep walking. And then ask for help. Talk to your sponsor. And I don't want to pretend like I'm going to sit and talk about the answer to anxiety in a few minutes, because I can't. It's a big, big thing. It's real. And I have a friend who she still has it after 20 something years of sobriety to a great extent, a really, really extreme extent. And she says she just practices accepting it. And she understands now. And so it's a kind of an additional part, not it's part of her, but it's something that happens. It's not who she is. Does that help? I hope it helps.
Thank you. So would you share a little bit about your experience with home groups, being a home group member? A lot of people talk about, I'm a member of a three legacy group. I'm very intrigued by the idea that I can't switch home groups until I'm resentment free. That was beautiful. all that's very interesting. So anything you'd care to share about the importance of home groups would be great.
Well, and all of that, you know, I think I know for myself, I learned some things on the way, and I'm a particularly curious person. But in my first home group, I did not know about the concepts. You know, I'd kind of seen them and I didn't really know them. And they seemed to sort of, they were so dry, they kind of just seemed to, and I had been a GSR, you know, but and we studied the service manual, but I just didn't digest them very well. But the traditions and the steps, and then the tradition, a three legacy home group, for those who are new, or we have recovery that are guided by the steps, our 12 steps. We have unity, which are guided by our traditions, our 12 traditions, and service, which are guided by our 12 concepts to help us carry the message out into the larger, to the world at large. So I was getting the hang of the traditions, although it took me a while to understand some of them just because of my experience. Like I said, I was a GSR in 1994, when they were just starting to talk about the printing a fourth edition of the Big Book. And I got to see how long it takes from the vote to the publication that we published in 2000 or 2001. And we started talking about it again. It wasn't the first time it had been brought up, but in 1994. So the home group, back to the home group. So a three legacy home group is one who really studies and teaches the three legacies, recovery, unity, and service. My first home group, we had Big Book studies and 12 and 12 studies, and we talked about steps and traditions a lot, but not so much the concepts. My second home group, same thing. They talked about the traditions a lot. The difference, I really had to learn the difference between a tradition and a custom in my second home group. That there are traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are 12 steps, 12 points to assure our future. And then there are customs of a group where each group decides how they want to, what format they want to have, how they want to have their commitments, which commitments they want to have. All of that stuff is customs and group decision. Whether or not they want you to wear a suit and a tie at the podium or a dress, which was became a point of contention for me after a while. Every group will cite tradition 4, and then I cite tradition 3, which we had to agree to disagree, and I moved on, but it's okay. The way I say it now is because Because so many different, I love a three legacy group. I would like that. But if I'm in my home group right now, we finally got our steering committee voted to hang the concepts on the wall. And so we're aware, we've had a concepts workshop, you know, and we're trying to bring them in. So to have everybody become conscious of that, that's really cool. Then this is my fourth home group. My third home group was very much a three legacy group. But all that said is that we as individuals are guardians of our fellowship. We as individuals, it is my responsibility to learn this, whether or not I'm here, and to bring what I can into my group. If I don't see it, Doug's grandma used to say, if you want to hear a song, sing it. And so I like that, you know, to bring what I'm not hearing and see what happens. So no matter, you know, whether or not I think somebody's listening, I'm trying to study up. I'm trying to get a practical, learn a practical application for each of these things so that I can share it. Because I started to realize that, you know, all those old timers I used to call old timers, I'm now moving to the front of the line. I'm not, you know, I'm going voluntarily, but I'm kind of being pushed too. And I want to be responsible. I want to know what it is that we're sharing. I want this to be here if, God forbid, my grandsons need it or their kids or, you know, and so on. I want it to be available. I hope that helped. That was a lot of talk.
So much. I'm saddened to say that we are at our time, but I thought I'm going to ask you one more little question, but I thought I'd give you some room if you wanted to, I don't know, do a parting thought or two, but people want to know who the speaker Cubby was.
Oh, Cubby Selby. And his real name was not Cubby. Honey, do you remember what Cubby's first name was? Herbert Selby. And he was also an author. He's long gone. He had terrible physical ailments for a while, but he was an AA speaker, an AA, just an awesome AA person. And that's who he was. And he was the one who said, I felt like a scream looking for a mouth.
Oh, just wonderful. Okay, so let's see.
It's so good to see you. You guys, thanks. And Harmony, you take good care. You take good care of her, Grant. You and vice versa. That's okay. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Carla. Let's see where I am. I got to orient myself. Okay, so we're going to thank Carla for sharing, of course, and all who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, we will unmute everyone and give you the chance to say thanks. I'm going to try to pull off a little screen share here and ask somebody to read a vision for you. BJ, you want to take that?
Yes, sir. My name is BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I always forget to publicly thank Larry for being the host, the questions wrangler. Thank you, Larry. And let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy
name.
Thy kingdom come,
thy
will be done,
on
earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Forever and ever. Amen. And
love you guys. Thank you, Carla. Thank you so much. Nice meeting you, Doug.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Carla, and I'm a huge Pema Chodron fan as well.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, because.